You're listening to Sci-Fi for Me Radio. To do anything else would be highly illogical.
Welcome, everyone, to this episode of The Echo Chamber. My name is Jason Hunt. I am the editor at scififorme.com. And the topic for today, this is maybe part four or part five in the ongoing saga of the Star Trek fan film. I don't know if there's a good word that you can use on the air for what's been going on. Joining me from various parts around the globe, they've been covering the story about the Axanar lawsuit, and now specifically what we're going to talk about today mostly are the new Star Trek fan film guidelines. But just to help set the plate, set the table, as it were, we have Michael Hinman from 1701 News, who was with us in our last discussion of this topic. He calls in from the island of Grenada. Hi, Michael.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. And also covering the editor of the AxaMonitor.com. AxaMonitor.com, which has been covering the story and has a really good comparison I'm going to get to a little bit later on between the Star Trek fan film guidelines and the Star Wars guidelines. Because that's been brought up before. Carlos Pedraza is with us from Palm Springs.
Unfortunately, only temporarily, but I'm glad I'm here. And I'm glad to be here with you guys.
And yeah, he'll be going home to Beverly Hills pretty soon.
Swimming pools and movie stars, right? And then on staff here, joining us from Milwaukee and Labs, and Dave Margosian.
Hello.
Hi.
From Southwest Illinois, our former intern, who's still now sticking around for whatever reasons she hasn't explained yet, Catherine Sanders is with us.
Hello.
And from Corpus Christi, Texas, my co-host on Sci-Fi XY, Sonia Rodriguez.
Hello.
And we are hoping to be joined a little bit later on, if the links will work, John Broughton from Farragut Films. We sent an invite, and we were hoping, originally we were set to record this earlier in the week, and he was going to be a part of it. We're hoping that still will be the case, as well as Don Simon, who's an intellectual property attorney here in Kansas City. We're hoping they both manage to dial in, assuming technology cooperates. So the topic for today, I mentioned we're going to talk specifically about the Star Trek fan film guidelines, but what I want to do just to start with, Michael and Carlos, I'm going to let you guys take this. Where are we at the moment in regard to the lawsuit from CBS Paramount against Axanar Productions?
You want to go first, Michael?
No, you go ahead, Carlos. You're the expert on this.
Well, we are in the middle of discovery, which means that after the motion to dismiss was dismissed by the judge in the case, they set a schedule for when the trial is supposed to happen, which is in January, if it isn't settled before then. In the meantime, the bulk of that time is going to be taken up in discovery. Discovery is the process in which both sides look for evidence to shore up their cases. It includes things like depositions and asking for documents and emails and all kinds of evidence that they hope to prove their side. That's an extraordinarily expensive and drawn-out process, which is one of the incentives for both sides to want to settle, short of going to trial. So that's where the lawsuit itself stands. I know that, or we all know, that on May 20th, J.J. Abrams and Justin Lin came out in favor of fan films being able to move ahead, and specifically Axanar, saying that the case was going to go away in a few weeks. That was misreported widely as the lawsuit being dropped, which it really wasn't. They've been in settlement talks for quite a while, and the big news actually was Paramount and CBS announcing that they were in fact working on fan film guidelines. And from my perspective, that was the biggest news of the night, because the settlement talks, really, those have been ongoing since at least March. So that's where we stand today. A few weeks later, we have the guidelines, and now we're figuring out how to live with them.
You know, and what's really interesting about when when J.J. Abrams got up in front of the crowd at that Star Trek event in May and said that this lawsuit was going away, my biggest fear wasn't, you know, I wasn't one of those people that thought, oh, they're dropping the suit because it's too late for that. But my biggest fear was that CBS and Paramount were then going to settle for far less than they could. They're in such a superior position right now because of the fact that every aspect of Axanar's motion to dismiss, even a couple of things that I thought might get struck from the lawsuit, all of it was totally denied. So CBS and Paramount are in a superior negotiating position. And I think the fact that we're, what, like almost 2 months later or close to 2 months later, yeah, and there still hasn't been a settlement, I think it means that CBS and Paramount are sticking to their guns and they're not going to give in to this very easily. And I think that the only way this lawsuit's going to end before a trial for Axanar is if Axanar totally goes away.
Now, one thing that I noticed, you both mentioned the denial of the motion to dismiss. I read that document, and what struck me about it, it really felt like a law professor critiquing a first-year law student's paper, basically saying, you've misapplied this one, you've misapplied this one, this doesn't work here, you can't use this one here, this doesn't work here, no, 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 no. And just like Michael says, every single item, the judge was basically saying, well, defense says this, but in the real world, it's this, and it really did feel like a takedown of Axanar's position quite a bit. And one of the reasons why I wanted to have Don and his input on this, because I think you're right. I think CBS and Paramount are 100% in their position. I don't think they can at this point. It doesn't look like they have any chance of losing this thing. Axanar doesn't have a case.
And that's not a surprise to any of us because, you know, if anybody has read the blogs that Janet Gershon-Siegel has written about this, I mean, she was calling this, I mean, every step of the way. It's like she was Babe Ruth out there hitting home runs and not missing a single one. I mean, she called every single one of this, and each time that we would all sit there and say, okay, yeah, what Janet's saying is making a lot of sense. You know, she was an attorney. She knows this stuff. Axanar would come back and say, oh, these are armchair lawyers. They have no idea what they're talking about. Yet, every single time, it's been proven right, and they've been proven wrong. So it's been very interesting.
Yeah, and the other thing that I've noticed, too, and this is on 1701. Michael, you've got an article here about the director of Prelude to Axanar, the short film, Christian Gossett. Finally coming out and making some comments, because I guess, and I am by no means any kind of legal expert at all, but I guess we're past the point where CBS and Paramount can name additional, because there were something like 20 or 25 additional John Doe slots in that lawsuit where they could name additional defendants, and I guess we're past that where they can do that legitimately. Is that right?
Yeah, we passed that on May 25th. However, there's always the possibility that during the course of discovery, they may find additional evidence that could bring another or more defendants into the suit. It's pretty clear from what their lawyers have said so far that they're not really inclined to go beyond just Alec Peters personally and Axanar Productions. My sense of that is it's a lot easier to refute the notion that this is a move against the fans when it's just one fan that infringed on copyright, allegedly infringed on copyright and allegedly received a direct financial benefit or a series of them that are at the center of this lawsuit. And I think that CBS and Paramount have been very careful about not wanting to go further afield than they need to. Because in addition to that, every new defendant that they add to the case tacks on more time, more effort, and more money to prosecute the case. And it's in their interest to get it settled or to trial as quickly as possible. And this is the best way to keep it on track.
And remember, the main reason why, in typical cases, the main reason why you would even put John Doe defendants in there, I mean, you want to have the placeholders just in case you add more, but the biggest thing that you want is you want to send a message to everybody else. When you file this lawsuit, and even though, like, let's say you're Robert Meyer Burnett or somebody else who's really high up there who could possibly be named, you know, the effort here is to try to get them to flip, basically to say, you know what? I don't want to be named as a defendant in this case. I'm going to flip over to the other side, and I'll provide materials or whatever else I need to strengthen the plaintiff's case. Although, to be honest, I don't think they really need that much of it, because I really think that they have a strong case even without anybody flipping. So.
Now, according to this article here that you've got on Gossett, there is a mention there that that Rob Burnett may be in an untenable position in terms of being able to have to make any comments. Now, my impression up until this point was that
he
was
stopped him though.
Well,
yeah,
Rob makes a lot of comments.
Yeah, he seems to talk a lot for somebody who's hindered, you know.
Well, no, and maybe not hindered in terms of being able to say things, but the impression that I get, and I could be misreading this, is that he's because, you know, up until a certain point, nobody was able to really talk about much. Now people are able to speak out, but Burnett seems to be in a unique position in that he's very high up. And if he is to speak out, then maybe there'd be some sort of backlash, or maybe he's worried about retaliation or something from Peters. I don't know. But it just seemed like, just from reading this, and it was a cursory read, that maybe Burnett would like to say other things than what he's actually saying, but I could be misreading that. The other question that I've got is about Terry McIntosh, because apparently the communication, according to this article here, Alec Peters told Terry McIntosh there is no money. Terry McIntosh, the digital software guy, the guy who is the chief technology officer for the production, and according to McIntosh, the communication to him was that the money was gone. And if you've got $1.3 million raised in Kickstarter funds or in crowdfunding, and if you're looking at a lawsuit wherein you're not able to complete the project that you've promised to the donors, isn't there a legal obligation? Doesn't and if I remember this right, Kickstarter and Indiegogo both have a clause that says if you don't deliver, we refund the money.
That's not actually how it works, because they no longer have the money. You know, they agree to make a good faith effort to produce whatever the product is that the Kickstarter is about, and in this case, what they're likely going to claim is, look, we made our good faith effort, and we were sued. They sued our pants off, so we're not able to produce this, and therefore no refunds are due. And that's probably going to be the case if the case goes in that direction. But unfortunately, donors are the ones who are in the worst possible position here, because they have no seat at any table regarding Axanar at this point. They're not a party to the lawsuit. They haven't brought any legal complaint of their own against Axanar, and we don't know where that money is. There was one rumor that I've tried all week to confirm that the money was put into an escrow account, but no one will confirm that. Certainly, if the money is somewhere, it's not liquid, if you were to believe what Alec Peters told Terry McIntosh back in May, the day after Terry resigned from Axanar, or it was a negotiating position that was in bad faith, claiming that you didn't have money when in fact you do. So we don't know the answer to those two things, other than a big question mark hovers over Axanar at this point as far as where that money is. The math I've done and the math other people have done indicates that they should have anywhere between $200,000 and $500,000 in the bank. I tend to believe that money is there, but that's just my gut on that. The escrow thing may be the way that they're keeping it, but again, no one will confirm that.
You know, and just jump into the Robert Meyer Burnett thing. You know, and Christian Gosset seems like a really good guy. And by the way, our story, that actually, you know, was based on an interview that he had done with Trek Zone, with Matthew Miller at Trek Zone, and a little bit from the G&T show, too, that he appeared on both of those. But my take, I didn't talk to him directly, but, you know, my take on that is that, you know, that these are people who've known each other. It seems that Robert Meyer Burnett and Christian Gosset have known each other even before Axanar.
Right.
And I think that he wants to believe. You know, that this is like one of those things where you have a friend for a long time, you know, like let's say you're friends with Jared Fogle, like since he was a kid, and you want to believe that he wasn't trafficking little girls across state lines, you know, when he was pitching Subway. But, you know, this is like you just want to believe in a way that deep down in Robert Meyer Burnett's heart that he understands that, you know, this is wrong and it's just Alec Peters is keeping him, you know, away from this. But I don't believe that because the tweets and every other communication that he has says the exact opposite of that. I don't see anything in there, you know, anything of this where there's like a hidden message deep inside that says, please help me. You know, these are messages where he honestly has drank the Kool-Aid. He honestly believes that this is the greatest Star Trek ever, that he is some massive filmmaker because he did an independent film 18 years ago, you know, and he does DVD extras now, and that, you know, that he needs to have, you know, $100 million to make a fan film. I mean, I think that he really is so, you know, deluded, whether that's in his brain or because he's, you know, drowning those beliefs. But either way, he has those beliefs, and I don't believe for a minute that Alec Peters is holding him back in any way.
Now, let me add at this point, I should have mentioned this earlier. We were talking about the various people who are participating. We did send an invitation to Alec Peters, and at first, it seemed like he had accepted, but turns out he had not. And I explained a little bit of this on the most recent H2O just to get that passed because I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on him today. But he did decline and did clarify that he did not want to participate. But the other thing that I've noticed with all of this, because you know, Tony Todd had come out and spoke after he had left the project, but he's still listed on the Axanar website as a member of the cast.
That's a little bit of a dodge, because if you look carefully, it says the cast of Prelude to Axanar.
Okay.
And most people miss that, just like you did, and I believe that's intentional. They want to continue to associate these names with the feature when that's not necessarily the case, certainly isn't in Tony Todd's case. And, you know, there was a pretty long time lag between the time Tony Todd left and the time that Axanar actually admitted that he had left.
Yeah.
And it was in excess of 3 months. He left in September, and Axanar did not acknowledge it until December, when directly asked by a fan on one of the boards. And it was only at that point that Tony Todd spoke up on Twitter and explained why he left. Still a little vague, but it did have to do with accountability for crowdfunding funds, the continued production delays. It was taking a long time to turn that $1.3 million into an actual film. And, you know, he's a busy man and has other things to do and decided he didn't want to stick around.
Well, and they
didn't like what he was seeing.
They had to take time to convert a warehouse into a studio instead of renting an already made studio.
Well, that's a really unfortunate thing, too. I mean, Michael carried a column by Jody Wheeler, who did the analysis on the costs for renting a studio, which is, by the way, what Christian Gosset had recommended to Alec and was ignored. You know, this is a town that is full of sound stages, and the idea that you had to build one before you could make Axanar is ridiculous. It's just patently not the case.
Yeah, I think in Los Angeles you could probably throw a rock in any direction and hit a sound stage of some.
Pretty much. So the problem was that it became an issue of changing priorities and moving the goalposts, and what was initially the goal of making this film, which actually might have been a good film, that took second place to building out the studio and creating the foundations for their own sci-fi streaming platform. And now we see the repercussions of that, because CBS and Paramount obviously see those kinds of things as crossing the line into direct financial benefit based on intellectual property that Axanar does not own.
I want to let the rest of the staff jump in here with any thoughts and questions they have, because we've been going around on this with the litigation part. Sonia, Catherine, and Dave, if you guys have any ideas or questions you want to throw at Carlos and Michael?
This just came as a thought to me. Part of the thing is, for me as a fan, I can't believe I'm siding with Paramount attorneys. But their fan guidelines seem remarkably reasonable, because you're talking about a fan film, not a semi-pro whatever this is. And at least as a Star Trek fan, it's not like there's a dearth of good product out there now. I mean, I can watch legitimate Star Trek that would probably be fine. But yeah, I'm siding with corporate attorneys, so it's very strange.
Yeah, that's one thing that's really made me kind of irritated, is I'm a person that does not like to side with mega corporations, and I was a business reporter for many years, and I still don't like to side with mega corporations. But on this particular case, even from the very beginning, back on January 2nd when I wrote my first opinion piece on the Axanar thing, it's like, I'm sorry, but I see CBS and Paramount's point on this, and I think that the fan film guidelines could have been far worse. Like, it could have been no fan film, and I think people keep forgetting that, mm-hmm. is that CBS and Paramount does not even have to allow fan films, yet they are, and I think this $50,000, you know, that they're allowed, is it $50,000?
Yeah,
$50,000.
Extremely generous.
It really is. I mean, Tommy Kraft made Star Trek Horizon for $50,000, and that's a feature-length film. So it's definitely possible. And you know, and I'll say this: having been a fan film producer and writer on two different series over the course of several years, you know, there's part of me that does that does grieve for this loss. I mean, it is a major bummer that we can't create long-form Star Trek content anymore, that we can't have ongoing series. And I think, you know, for myself, if I were still in fan films, I would miss that. But at the same time, there's still plenty of room to play in that playground. And, you know, something that that John Van Sitters from CBS Licensing pointed out a couple of weeks ago was that this is the first time that any major copyright holder, any studio, any publisher, anything like that, has actually given people permission through these guidelines to make use of intellectual property they don't own.
Right.
Relatively free of the threat of any kind of litigation. That's unprecedented. Furthermore, the studios tend to follow one another, so everyone's going to be watching this to see how well it works out, and it may pave the way for similar kinds of guidelines to come from the other studios. In fact, these guidelines, these Star Trek guidelines, clearly take some direction from what you see as the contest rules for the Star Wars fan film contest.
Right.
There's some direct lines
that you see between those.
Now, I was noticing that as well, too, that it followed, like, contest guidelines, too. When I was reading through the guidelines, I was thinking, oh, okay, that makes sense. All this makes sense. The one guideline that kind of hit me like, whoa, that's, wow, is the fact that they can't use anybody who's been on a, for lack of better language, a real Star Trek show. They can't use any of those actors.
Yeah,
that means if you've done anything.
Not just actors.
Anybody. Anybody who has worked, produced, done anything, they can't use it. And right. I had read that sometimes the actors kind of, you know, they go on these fan films just to kind of show off and have fun. And I thought that was kind of a blow to them. That's it. They're done with. If they're not working for Star Trek, they're not working.
But
at
it
all.
Makes sense, but you know, but it makes sense to do that because I think what John Van Sitter said in the Engage podcast at StarTrek.com was that what was happening is that a lot of people who might have wanted to do fan films could never compete. It's not that there's a competition, but you know, obviously, if you make a fan film, you want people to see it. But you know, but when you have people like Axnard, you know, pretty much snubbing their nose at other fan productions, and it seemed like everybody was just going one step further. It's like, well, let's get this guy. No, but let's get this guy. Oh, but no, we have one of the writers from Star Trek. Oh no, we have three of the actors. All right, now we're going to raise this much money. We're going to raise. It turned into an arms race, and that's exactly what was happening.
So they kind of shut it down. They just shut it down. So that nope, you have to do it without us. Period.
Well, and funny,
do it without us.
That term actually, Van Sitter's actually used the term arms race when he's talking about all of this because it is a question of one-upsmanship. I mean. For whatever opinion that you have of Phase 2 New Voyages, that was the one that broke the ground on all of this. And that was the one that sat there and said that these fan productions could look almost as good as the real thing. And you have professionals on the production who are in cinematography and lighting and visual effects and all of that. And Colley, of course, having connections in with the costuming and making all of this happen, everybody looked at that and they went, oh, that's what it could be like. And then it became, well, how can we do that? And then how can we do it better? And then, you know, now you've got Star Trek Continues, who's got Jimmy Doohan's son playing Scotty. I mean, nobody else is going to be able to get a Scotty who's as close to the original as the actor's son. I mean, come on.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, you know, and the thing is that New Voyages really was the springboard for all of these.
Yeah.
And yet, at the same time, New Voyages is the one that has stuck most closely to the notion that this is a production by fans for fans.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it did not create an industry built on its own fan films. It is basically summer camp for Star Trek fans, and that happens to produce a fan film every year, you know. And but it was the springboard for all of these other productions that you're talking about. I mean, the Renegades people, many of them started, you know, in Of Gods and Men, which was filmed in partnership with New Voyages, and Star Trek Continues. I mean, some of those cast members are people I cast on Star Trek New Voyages that went over to the. To Continues. So there's a direct line between all of the major fan films and New Voyages, and I think almost all of them respected the line that you do not commercialize.
Right.
There's some that towed that line. Renegades probably towed that line a little bit, but Axanar stepped over it and went the furthest of anyone, and that's why anyone who tries to compare what Axanar has done with what New Voyages or Continues or Renegades has done, they're, you know, we're all sinners when it comes to infringement. But the difference is that none of those other productions made it an industry. They didn't commercialize. They didn't monetize. They didn't pay their producers' salaries. And that's the difference. And it's a huge one.
And you mentioned, you know, the fact that these are the first official guidelines for fan productions outside of the Star Wars contest. And really, you can only make that comparison for so far because the Star Wars guidelines are specifically for the contest itself, not for fan films in general. And so the fact that Star Trek has these guidelines out now, and you mentioned how other studios will be looking for that, for the longest time, and we've seen this especially with Marvel, with superhero stuff, because you look at Bat in the Sun, or you look at some of the other, you know, Chris Noderil or some of the other producers who do Marvel or DC fan films, you know, all of these guys are essentially turning a blind eye to all of these productions. As long as you don't go over a particular line, and each corporation is going to make that line in a different place. But as long as you treat the characters with respect and you treat the intellectual property with respect, everybody's been kind of able to just play in the sandbox and no harm, no foul. But I think you're right. I think this is going to be the beginning of a trend. I think the Star Trek guidelines are the beginning, and we're going to start seeing guidelines from everybody else, and maybe some of those are going to be a little bit more draconian.
It's going to be a wait and see game, I think, to see how the Star Trek fan films respond to these guidelines. And there have been a lot of responses. We've been tracking on AxeMonitor what the various Star Trek fan films are doing in response to these guidelines. And of course, in the couple of days right after they were released, everyone was like throwing up their hands and saying, "Oh, we can't do this. This is too much of a straitjacket." And then John Van Sitters did his Engage podcast on StarTrek.com, and he clarified both the content, context, and reach, legal reach of these guidelines in ways that I think mollified a lot of the fears that producers had. And I was just counting this morning on our updated chart on AxeMonitor that of the 28 fan films that are listed there, more than half are resuming production in one form or another. People are adapting. People should adapt. And I think, and again, I say this in the context of a former fan film producer, that I would love to go back to the old way because there weren't any major restrictions and you could do what you wanted. But also looking at it from a production standpoint and a legal standpoint and even a creative standpoint, limits are good. There is nothing that forces a writer or a producer to hone a production more than some kind of constraint, whether that's money or running time those are the two big ones here. And I think you will start to see some very creative approaches from some of these producers because I know they're creative people and they will find a way to tell interesting stories. They won't be the stories we told before, but there'll be ones that won't operate under the shadow of possible litigation.
Well, you know, I was just going to say, as a fan, when I read Star Wars fanfic, it's to see stuff you wouldn't see in the film, or hidden corners, or untold stories. The creative part is the appealing part, not how slavishly it copies the property.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's the good thing.
Yeah, and I was going to say, like, I wasn't there for the whole Star Wars when all fan stuff was banned back when George Lucas was primarily in charge, but I know a lot of people that were, and they say that, like, this regulation will be more of basically honing everybody's ability to be able to create their fan productions without it being totally driven underground like it was in the past.
Well, and
the thing about creativity, by the way, just, you know, and going on is where, you know, when you are limited in terms of, you know, where it's money, people, or even the scope of what you're doing. But
yeah,
to me, the best creators, and kind of like what Carlos was saying, is like, you know, my career's been a newspaper. I can do newspapers inside and out. You put me in front of Quark Express or, you know, or any of the big programs stuff, I could lay out a paper in 10 minutes. But the real skill is, if I didn't have Quark Express, for instance, which is a program we used to lay out newspapers, one of them, you know, if I didn't have that, if I didn't have InDesign, could I still take Microsoft Word and lay out a newspaper? You know, could I still find ways of doing it with limited resources? And, you know, and that's what I think is also a true test of on the creation, not just the creation side of the story, but on actually producing it and putting it together. So when Robert Meyer Burnett says, I am a filmmaker, I cannot make this film for less than $5 million, but then I look at Tommy Kraft, who made a really good fan film, a feature-length fan film, Star Trek Horizon, for less than $50,000 in his parents' basement. And then it makes me wonder, so who is the better filmmaker here, Robert Meyer Burnett or Tommy Kraft? And, of course, I go to Tommy Kraft every single time.
And I think, you know, the issue is also that, in my mind, the better filmmaker is the one that actually makes the film.
And, yeah, that's a good one too.
Snap.
Yeah, that works too.
I mean, it's kind of mean, but it's also true. There was a clear prioritization in which the production of Axanar was not their highest priority, and that's really
right.
Clear.
And you can
even see, if you look at their fundraising, like I charted it out on AxeMonitor, you can see where that change happened. It literally happened at a point in time in which you saw their eyes go wide and their goals go wider, and they decided, this is what we need to do. And, oh, by the way, we can build our own studio. They did that in the reverse that I would have done it in. And furthermore, so many of these critiques or attacks or whatever Axner supporters want to call it, so many of them are would never have even come up if they just produced something.
Right.
You know, I mean, you can look at Renegades, and people have criticized Renegades for different things, but the fact of the matter is they produced something. You know, they did it. And Axnar can't say the same thing. And as promising as Prelude was, and it was promising, it was a very unique and creative take on fan films. But the feature was never going to follow the same format. And, you know, it promised a lot. And we didn't see any indication other than what they'd done for Prelude that the same quality was going to come out of the feature. I mean, features are very different animals from shorts. And having directed both, I can tell you, not directed, produced both, I can tell you that it's an order of magnitude or two from one to the other. Carrying a narrative storyline for an hour and a half to 2 hours is punishing on writers and producers and actors and crew. You know, they shot Prelude in a couple of days, I think, and maybe another day of pickups. But they were looking at easily 3 to 4 weeks of production on this, and they didn't even have anywhere near the money to do it. They only had raised, by the time their Indiegogo closed, they'd only raised 44% of the budget that they needed to even complete Axanar. So even if CBS said today you can go, they don't have enough money to make what they promised.
Right.
And they're already over the limits that CBS and Paramount have given for fan films. So they would, by definition, have to make something that is less than what they promised. And it's an unfortunate thing, and it could have been avoided if they'd actually reprioritized.
Well, and having shot an 80-minute feature film myself in a week, I can tell you that it is a grueling process that even if you have all of the money and all of the resources in the world, it is a very taxing thing to do. Okay, so here's what we're going to do. We're going to take a break here, and we've touched on it just a little bit about fan reaction to the guidelines, fan reaction to the lawsuit. We're going to go through the guidelines. We're not going to read them one at a time, but we'll go through the guidelines and discuss the impact of those when the Echo Chamber continues right after this.
You're listening to the Echo Chamber on Sci-Fi for Me Radio.
I'm meteorologist Brian Busby. If you're traveling to a convention this weekend, especially if you're a cosplayer, it helps to know what the weather's going to be like. Rain and fur don't mix very well now, do they? That's why every week, Sci-Fi for Me gives you the weather forecast for every city hosting a convention. Those we have on our list, anyway. And that's worldwide, not just in the United States. It's part of our commitment to bring you content you won't find anywhere else. Just click on the Conventions tab over at scififorme.com, your portal to the science fiction multiverse.
Atomic Cotton, where Erica and Zach combine their passion for art and film to create wearable art. All original, made with a love for the genre. Coming to a convention near you very soon. Or find them on the web at atomiccotton.com. Atomic Cotton, shirts and art for fans by fans.
This is Dustin, and I co-host Zompocalypse Now on Sci-Fi for Me. So come and listen to me talk about Zompocalypses.
And now, back to the Echo Chamber on Sci-Fi for Me Radio.
Back in the Echo Chamber, Jason Hunt here, along with our panel of experts, Michael Hinman from 1701 News. Where did Michael go? Michael, you there?
Oh, I was just supposed to say something? I'm sorry.
You're fired, Michael.
just making us wait, aren't you? Yeah. Carlos Pedraza from AxiomMonitor.com.
Hi.
Sonia Rodriguez from Corpus Christi, Texas. Here are our staff.
Hello.
Ann Labs and Dave Margosian, staff writers from Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Hello.
Yo.
And Catherine Sanders, who is a staff writer from Southwest Illinois.
Hello.
And we are now going to get into the Star Trek fan film guidelines. And I have to say that I want to congratulate everybody on not getting into the bash Alec Peters hour. So far, we've done fairly well, I think. But these guidelines, let's look specifically at those. And I think one thing that strikes me at the very beginning of all of this, even before you get into the actual guidelines themselves, the way they've got the header on here, it says guidelines for avoiding objections. Mm-hmm. And given the fact that this is lawyer speak, that the lawyers have sat down in the room and said, okay, here's how this has to go. The fact that they're using the word objections rather than, you know, cease and desist or, you know, whatever other terms they could put in there, basically kind of tells me that there's going to be, if your production straddles the line a little bit, it seems to me that there's going to be some preliminary communication that says, hello, knock, knock, knock. You need to make some adjustments before we take action. It doesn't
absolutely.
It doesn't look like this is going to be. And from the impression that I got from John Vincitter's talk on Engage, it seems like that's going to be the process. Is that they're going to look at individual productions,
case by case basis.
Yeah, and any of them that skirt, you know, right there on the edge. Maybe there's going to be some communication back and forth. But then you go back to something that Alec Peterson said when he mentioned, you know, he claims to have met with CBS representatives at the Star Trek event in Las Vegas a couple of years ago, where he's making the case that, well, CBS didn't tell us no, so, you know, but, you know, in those particular cases, and we've seen this in other places, the corporate representatives can't tell you what you can or cannot do in an illegal, I mean, for lack of a better word, all of these are infringements. And if they were to sit there and go, okay, you can infringe this way, but not this way, that's basically sanctioning an unofficial production and making it official. So I can understand where the CBS people are sitting there going, we can't make any comment on what your production is doing. But now that there's guidelines, they can.
Mm-hmm. But you see, I don't even believe that story that Axanar has put out there. And sorry, I know that this is probably going against the don't bash Axanar rule. But the thing is that they had this meeting last August. You know, everybody's admitted that. So now we can say it's definitely happened. A week later, CBS at least puts out a statement. CBS or Paramount, I can't remember which one. They put out a statement saying to the rap that, you know, basically giving a huge warning to Axanar. There is no other way that you can read the statement that CBS put out there, which was, we will not tolerate commercialization of our IP, and if it doesn't stop, we're going to take action. I mean, that's basically a cease and desist right there in print for everybody to see.
Right.
So I have a hard time believing that Alec Peters was not told anything in that meeting, that the CBS people just sat there and twiddled their thumbs and spoke around in circles. They probably, you're probably right. They probably wouldn't say, well, you can't do this, but you can do this. But I'm sure they said, I'm sorry, we have a problem with how you may be commercializing this, and we are not going to tolerate it.
And the commercialization was extensive. I mean, the merchandise that they create and sell on a store, on their website, using an e-commerce platform, this is all such an extent we've never seen in a fan film before. And, you know, Michael is right that the accounts of that meeting in August were different. John Vancitters was one of the people in that meeting. You know, so he obviously was not at liberty to speak directly about the lawsuit because he's likely to be a witness in it.
Right.
But he did make it quite clear that commercialization was what pushed CBS to take this action. And no other fan film was commercializing or monetizing or creating actual ongoing revenue streams in the way that Axanar had. So this idea that they weren't told or they weren't warned is a red herring, because you know, the article that the rap did was about the meeting that Alec Peters had with John Sitters and Bill Burke from CBS, and the statement they got with direct relationship to that meeting was exactly what Michael said. They objected to, you know, professional commercial ventures profiting off our intellectual property.
Right.
And they were speaking specifically about Axanar, because they said in the first part of that statement, you know, we have told these people that we are not sanctioning, approving, or anything like that, this project.
And that actually goes to item number 6 on the guidelines, where they break down, you know, the fan production must be non-commercial. And you've only got, you have a limit of $50,000 for the production. Exhibited and distributed on a no-charge basis, shared with streaming services without generating revenue. I mean, this is probably the longest of any of the guidelines, and it's very specific in its breakdown of here's all the different ways you cannot make money doing this.
They don't even want your movie on a DVD. They don't even want something to hold. Nothing.
Right.
Nothing. No. Nothing to keep. Nothing to hold. It's got to be uploaded or something. I don't know. I was,
well, in all fairness, with how easy it is to burn DVDs in this day and age, it's not even really necessary.
Well, I mean, the thing about it is there's a transactional definition there that if I'm producing the film and you give me money for making the film and I hand you a DVD in exchange or as an end result, then technically there is an exchange
of
material goods.
Something.
I just sold it. So that defines it as a commercial venture. So I can see where they can do that. I mean, sure, you make it, I make it free, you download it, you burn it to a DVD, that's on you.
Yeah. And I think, you know, CBS, they didn't just come up with these guidelines because of Axanar. They've been in the works for some time now. And
oh, really? You think?
Yes. Oh, I know that. I know that.
Okay.
So Axanar pushed the point. I mean, because they were watching what was going on, and it was clear that crowdfunding pushed all of these productions to a new level.
Yeah.
And that's when, essentially, in John Van Sitter's words, the arms race started. And, you know, an arms race for Hollywood talent and fundraising is the way he put it, I believe. And that certainly was happening. So they were keeping an eye and thinking about, okay, what is really commercialization, and does crowdfunding count as revenue, and all of those questions. And there are different constituencies within CBS. You know, you have the lawyers, you have the people in licensing, many of whom are actually very supportive of fan films. You know, and then you've got other constituencies, some of whom wanted to end all fan films. So what we got in these guidelines was in many ways a compromise from a committee, and so they are what they are.
Which of the guidelines do you think came directly from Axanar, and which ones do you think were already going in place?
Well, the idea that a production must be non-commercial is... that doesn't come from Axanar. That's something that's always sort of been the line. But what does come from Axanar is obviously the restriction in the amount of fundraising.
Right.
The idea of physical media like DVDs and Blu-rays and CDs, which Axanar has produced all of those. You know, one of the things Axanar, the idea around revenue, although I don't think Axanar really did any actual advertising through their websites or as pre-roll or post-roll on their online versions of Prelude, but that's a reasonable thing for any production to avoid commercializing and creating revenue.
And basically, in that case, what that is, if you upload your fan film to YouTube, you can't turn on the monetization tab. You have to keep it saying there are no going to be ads.
Now, this next one is an important one, which is no unlicensed Star Trek-related or fan production-related merchandise or services offered for sale or given away as premiums, perks, or rewards in connection with the fan production fundraising. That is aimed squarely at Axanar and what it has done. Now, obviously, it has effects on all the other fan films because they made use of crowdfunding as well, And my understanding was that, you know, before the guidelines came out, and I had gotten learned about what was going to be in them about 3 weeks before they were released. So it wasn't a surprise to me. And one of the things that knocked my socks off when I learned about this from the source that I had was that they said they were going to continue to allow crowdfunding. And, you know, the skinny that everyone was talking about at the time was, oh, crowdfunding is going to be the first thing that they get rid of. And in point of fact, they haven't. But what they did was say you can no longer give away physical perks anymore. If fans want to offer money to a production, that is okay with them up to that limit of 50,000 per 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. But
and they have to give it out of the goodness of their hearts.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's actually pretty big, because really when you look at the people, especially some people who have donated to Axanar, the biggest complaints that you kind of see when people are actually complaining, some of the donors, isn't, hey, where's my film? It's, hey, where are my perks? You know, and that's kind of what it came down to, where it's just like that people were donating not because that they, oh, this Axanar or whatever, Star Trek Continues or anybody who's crowdfund, not that, oh, these are great products, but in a way it was like, oh, I want this patch or I want this model or I want something else. It was turning into where they were basically,
oh, interesting.
It's basically a store. I mean, just like their donor store, where you make a donation and at a certain amount we'll give you certain perks. It's just like me going to the grocery store saying, here's a donation of $100. They're like, oh, thank you. As a perk, let's give you this food. I mean, that's not, you know, it's not a donation. It's a transaction.
Mm. Yeah.
Mm. A commercial transaction.
Yeah.
So let's look at the aftermath of here, because you mentioned, Carlos, you've mentioned Renegades a couple of times. Renegades has decided to remove all of their references to Star Trek and become an independent, brand new, on its own production. Where are we saying? I'm looking at your list here, and I didn't realize that there were so many productions ongoing right now in progress at the moment. I mean, I knew
not
about
even all of them. Yeah, there's 28 that are listed.
I knew about Potemkin and Valiant and Yorktown. Reliant was going to shoot down at Starbase Studios in Oklahoma City. We had talked to them last year, I think. And I'm looking at a lot of these. I'm like, I've never even heard of some of these productions. But the two biggest ones, of course, Star Trek Continues and Phase 2 New Voyages. You've been involved in New Voyages, and I am given to understand that James Cawley has just decided it's done. Is that the case? Is that actually what we're looking at with New Voyages?
I think that there's some exploration around what they may do next. I think that in response to the guidelines, or knowing that the guidelines were coming down the pike, James Cawley and New Voyages decided that, you know, because one of the things that's in the guidelines is no series. Mm-hmm. So a web presence for a series was something he knew would no longer be allowed. Each fan film you make is supposed to be a standalone production, which isn't to say that you can't have the same characters or the same settings, but they're not supposed to be continuing voyages, as it were, you know, or sequels or serialization. That's going to be a gray area. We'll have to see how that actually works out as these fan films start to produce, fan productions start to produce their individual stories. Because some of them, you know, the idea that they can't do a series anymore was almost a death blow to them. Mm-hmm. So I think that, and I haven't talked to James directly about this, we're due for a phone call, but I think he is considering what it might mean for the way that he has run that production, and exploring whether or not that is a new kind of film that he wants to produce.
Well, if I'm reading it right, and I could, you know, I've learned how to creatively interpret some words at some point. But if I'm reading this first guideline, the fan production must be less than 15 minutes for a single self-contained story, or no more than two segments, episodes, or parts, not to exceed 30 minutes total, with no additional seasons, episode, parts, sequels, or remakes. And if I squint at it just right, I can make the case that that limits me from making Deep Space Nine type of episodes where there's a season-long arc, and instead I could make the original series episodes where it's just a self-contained episode that tells a story and there's no change in our main characters and there's no plot development other than here's the beginning and the middle and the end of this story and it's done. Or do like the Menagerie where you have part one and part two, but you never revisit that story, so it doesn't get another episode which would be self-contained using the same character. It doesn't say you can't use the same characters. It says you can't continue the story through more than 30 minutes of material. So if I read that right, a series could continue in production as long as the episodes don't carry over from one to the next. Am I reading that wrong? Does that...
Well, with an abundance of caution, I would say this. And again, I haven't been able to ask this question directly to John Van Sitters or anyone like that at CBS. But with an abundance of caution, I believe that if you market your fan films as part of a series, that's not going to fly. Now, you can create, so essentially, if you start from scratch each time, you're okay. So you can't have, you know, Star Trek New Voyages and then episode title.
Right.
It's got to be just episode title. And you have to have a website for just that episode. If you create any kind of overarching organization, studio, whatever you want to call it, there you're starting to tread on the notion, again, that they do not want to support a cottage industry of fan right. films. They yeah. want to support the creation of fan films, and but I think the safest way to interpret that is about 90% of what you said, but the 10% that's important is don't make it look and sound like a series, because that's over that line.
So what if I...
It almost...
Go ahead. Go ahead, Sonia.
Oh, it almost reads like they only want you to make one. Like, one person make one, and that's the only one you're ever going to make. And then let everybody else make one.
No, you can make a different idea in the... Mm-hmm. Just have a new story. Like, you don't write the same story over and over.
Right.
But
sometimes, it doesn't restrict it, but it almost seems like that's almost what they want.
Well,
they just want everybody to make one.
It does sound a little bit like that.
It would be an easier world if that were the case, but I don't think that's the aim. I think what the aim is, as represented by that guideline, is we don't want you creating an overarching studio. We don't want you creating an industry out of your Star Trek
right.
stories.
Right.
We want them each to be a standalone fan production made by fans for fans, and anything that starts to stray away from that is not going to be looked on with favor. So the advice I've given people who've asked me, and of course this is just from my own reading, is that you need to make these individual productions, these individual stories, as standalone as possible. You possibly could get away with something like From the Creators of whatever the previous one was, but that's not part of your title, nor do you have the same web presence or Facebook presence for connecting these different stories.
Well, let me ask you this. Let's say I want to make more than one using the same characters, but I'm going to do a different title for each one, and I just put them on my personal YouTube channel. There's no studio, there's no production company. It's just me. Here's my YouTube channel. Here are the different Star Trek fan films that I've produced, and they're individual standalone things. There's no corporate, quote unquote, corporate presence there. Is that still going to get me a ding from CBS, or is that something that is still in that nebulous gray area that you know, CBS licensing is going to have to look at it on a case by case and sit there and go,
I think that's a case by case. Because if you're putting it under your own name, as opposed to a production name, you know, they may look the other way on that. And I, you know, one of the things that, that John Van Sitters emphasized in that, in his interview, was that they're not turning into the copyright police. They're not going to have a squad of going to every single fan film that's out there and going through their books and going through their scripts and looking at their costumes and where the tags inside them come. They're just not going to do that. Yeah. They fundamentally, they don't want to have to put their fingers into productions any more than they absolutely have to. And so, you know, even he said, like, okay, let's say your first episode goes 15 minutes and 5 seconds. The Goon Squad isn't going to come visit you. but you go to 20, 25, I think you're probably going to see some kind of action, some kind of nudge made about what you should and shouldn't be doing. But at this point, I think trying to flout these rules or look for loopholes is not the best idea. If you want to see a change in these guidelines, we need to live under them for a while. And at some point, they're likely to be revised because they'll have experience at that point. And we would love them to be revised in a way that's a little more or a little less restrictive than what they are today.
Well, and it's still to their benefit to have fan films. It's still to their benefit.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, and the other rule that a lot of people are squawking about is rule number 4. If the fan production uses commercially available Star Trek uniforms, accessories, toys, and props, these items must be official merchandise and not bootleg items or imitations of such commercially available products. And everybody is sitting there going, "Oh, you mean we have to buy our uniforms from Anavos? We can't just make it?" And I think they're reading that wrong. I think that basically this is saying.
John Van Sitters clarified that too.
I think they're not reading it wrong. I think it's actually worded wrong.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think Carl was about to say that John Van Sitters did clarify that. It's not saying you can't make your own uniforms. It's not saying that. What they basically don't want, and Carlos, make sure I'm right on this, but basically they don't want you to be going and buying like bootleg uniforms from somebody else to go make them. You know, if you're going to buy uniforms, you need to buy official uniforms, or you can just make your own. I mean, you know, but I do think they need to. I think they need to fix the wording on a couple of these rules because they are written differently from what John Van Sitters is saying.
So. Yeah, and I think what you're seeing there is an example that this was written by committee and was trying to serve various different constituencies, and the constituency behind this one is the group of licensees from CBS, Star Trek licensees, who they have an exclusive license for these things, and so CBS is obligated to defend that exclusive license, and consequently you have this, which basically says if you're not going to make your own, because making your own, there's nothing illegal about that.
It's when you
support people who are making it in bulk or as a business. That's where you're going to run into problems, and so, so this is a nod to the licensees saying we're looking out for you and insisting that that if they are going to go shopping for Star Trek props, costumes, anything like that, it must be from you, our licensees.
But which actually makes sense.
You. Yeah, and that makes sense. I think that's fair. Once he clarified that, I think that a lot of people breathed a sigh of relief.
All right. So, any other random thoughts or reactions to this? I know we had talked about getting to fan reactions. This sense of entitlement that fans have. You know, how dare the corporate demons come down on people? But we're already onto an hour here, so I think we'll bypass that for now. But one thing that I do want to note is that. For whatever opinion that you may have of these guidelines that CBS and Paramount put out, you talk about the restrictions of them, the fact that they only allow for so much. When you compare them to the Star Wars guidelines, the limitations are far fewer than the Star Wars guidelines are. Because Star Wars, it's 5 minutes. and you can only use this particular sound effect set mm-hmm. that we provide. And you know, mm-hmm. there are a lot more limitations within the context of the fan film competition that Lucasfilm does. And you know, maybe now that these guidelines are out, maybe the Star Wars guidelines will loosen up a little bit, and they'll actually, mm-hmm. you know, maybe they'll spread them out and say, well, not just for the contest, now this is for any fan film, and since Star Trek is doing it this way, you know, especially with Abrams having his fingers in both pies now, maybe maybe the Lucasfilm okay. guidelines loosen up a little bit more, and they start to resemble what Trek has just done. And then, you know, who knows, you know, we go a year, 2 years, and everybody's making nice, everybody's playing by the rules, mm-hmm. and CBS can sit there and go, okay, you want to do 30 minutes? We'll let you do 30 minutes and see what happens from there. I think it's going to be, you know, we have square one, and mm-hmm. now it's just basically like Von Sitter says, you know, everybody's got a new starting point, and now yeah. we just go from there and see what happens.
Yeah, I was just going to say that this is definitely like first draft or a beta. Like, this is definitely going to evolve as time goes on, and especially as the internet itself evolves. It's also kind of nice to see the corporate go through the internet to do this also, because it really feels like they understand that there are fans that want to do this, and I think that's a good thing, and I think we're going to go towards a more symbiotic relationship between corporations and fans. And I like what CBS is, basically what I'm saying is I like what's, as a fan that's not yet a content creator myself, I like what CBS is doing, and I think that this is going to head towards mostly better things.
Yeah, I mean, you just stop and consider back in the early 70s, there was this guy who wanted to make his own Flash Gordon fan film, and wasn't able to do that, and ended mm-hmm. up making this little thing called Star Wars. So you never know where any of this is going to go.
Yeah.
All right, well, that's going to do it for us. If you have opinions, comments that you would like to share with us on the Star Trek guidelines, especially if you're involved in a fan film, let us know what the impact is going to be on your particular production. You can send us an email, echochamber@scififorme.com, or you can leave a comment on our social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, are our main ones. We're also on Tumblr and YouTube and Instagram and Twitch, and I don't know whatever else is out there. We're probably going to look at it. We're not on Snapchat. We're not on MySpace. So
No one's on MySpace anymore.
All right, that's going to do it for us. I want to thank our panel, Michael Hinman from 1701 News.
Thanks for having me on, and I'm sorry. And I'm sorry that Alec Peters wasn't brave enough to come on the show, on the same show that Carlos and I were on.
His loss. And Carlos Pedraza from AxiomMonitor.com.
Thanks for having me.
And then our own staff, Catherine Sanders.
Thanks.
Sonia Rodriguez.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Ann Labs and Dave Margosian.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And on behalf of all of us here at Sci-Fi for Me, my name is Jason Hunt. Thank you very much for listening to this podcast. You can check out other podcasts on iTunes and podcast.com. And as always, get the latest news over at scififorme.com. That's going to do it for us. Thank you very much for listening to this Echo Chamber on Sci-Fi for Me Radio.
This has been a presentation of Sci-Fi for Me Radio. Copyright 2016 by Flaming Dog Media, LLC. All rights reserved. No portion of this program may be retransmitted without the express written consent of Flaming Dog Media. This is Sci-Fi for Me Radio.